We're going to talk now about why people buy. And it's very, very important to understand this because people buy for whose reasons? Our reasons or their reasons? They buy for their reasons. And the biggest mistake that amateur salespeople make is they try to ask people to buy for their reasons, their personal reasons, rather than taking the time to identify the needs of the other. Now, every human action, and this is very important, is aimed at an improvement in the condition of the person acting. In other words, every single thing that we do is an attempt to improve our relative condition. Every single buying decision is an attempt to be better off as a result of having made that decision than worse off. And the individual who's making a buying decision has three choices. They can either buy from you, they can buy from someone else, or they can buy from no one. They can refrain from purchasing, if you like. And when we talk about being better off, we're not talking about just materially. Sure, if you buy a car, you're better off, you've got a car. But we're talking about all of the other satisfactions that are involved. For instance, if you buy a car, you're out a certain amount of money. You're locked into a certain automobile. If you have difficulties with the automobile, then you're stuck with it. If you give up the money, then you can't buy something else. So you lose the flexibility and freedom of the money. So when we talk about a purchase decision being a decision to achieve an increment of satisfaction, we're talking about a physical increment. We want to be more satisfied emotionally, physically, spiritually. We want to be more satisfied in a variety of different areas. Sometimes we'll make a proposal to someone that is obviously the best price for the best product that they need. Their need is not just the best price and the best product. Their need may be to have a product that is better known so that other people in the company will not say that they've bought an unknown product. Their need may be to buy from someone from another business that their company sells to. It may be a totally different need than just simply price and quality. And it is in identifying the needs that is most important. That's where all professional selling begins, is in need analysis. And you're not in a position to sell until you have spoken to the individual long enough to understand what need of the prospect your product or service can satisfy, and then you structure your presentation so it satisfies that need. For instance, when we do need analysis, we say, what is the key result or benefit of our product? What is it that your product does that hooks or combines with a primary need of the customer? Most people are motivated by fear of loss and desire for gain. Fear of loss is fear of failure, and desire for gain is a desire to be better off. Now, most people are pulled between these two poles. They want to gain, but they don't want to lose. And your job is to move them away from the feeling that they'll be worse off to the feeling that they will be extremely well off. And you can demonstrate how easily this is true. If a person was absolutely convinced that they would be far better off as a result of purchasing your product than not, would they hesitate to make the decision? Of course not. If they absolutely believed you and believed in the value and believed in the quality and the relative price relative to the competition, do you think they would hesitate in purchasing your product? Of course not. So your job is to get the person to the point where they are completely focused on how they will gain or how they will be ahead by using your product rather than how much they might lose by committing themselves to your product. Now, some of the basic subconscious needs that people have, these are drives that motivate us, that will cause us to sacrifice, that will cause us to suffer, that will cause us to pay sometimes enormous sums, are people want to be rich. Everybody wants to be rich. Why? Because wealth represents security. When we have enough money, it means that we don't worry, we're secure. And the deepest craving of all of human nature is the craving for security. Whether it's financial security or emotional security or spiritual security, we need to feel secure. It's the basic need in Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Until we feel a certain level of security, we are preoccupied with that to the exclusion of almost everything else. Another thing that we need is we want to be admired. We want to be liked. We want to be respected. We want to be successful. We want to be successful in our own mind. We want to be successful relative to others. When we structure our product offering in such a way that we suggest to people that they will achieve one of these needs as a result of taking our product, or better yet, achieve several of these needs, what we do is we are making a very, very powerful bid for the prospects or the customer's time and money. We also want to be healthy. That's why health products are so much the rage today. Everybody wants to be healthier because one of our preoccupations every single day is our health. We have aches, we have pains, we're overweight, we're underweight, we sleep too much, we sleep too little. We're always concerned about our health, so we're always attracted to products or services that will enable us to be healthier. We also want prestige. We want to be respected in our community. We want recognition for our accomplishments. That's why prizes and companies that are continually doing things for their people that make them feel valuable are companies that are more successful. We want social status. The psychological needs are the deepest of all subconscious needs and the ones that we will pay the most to satisfy. We also want power. We want influence. We want popularity. We want self-expression. For instance, one of our drives is to be thought to be up to date, to be current, to be modern. Many people will make a buying decision because this is the newest product in the market, and they want to be ahead of the pack. Some people make a buying decision because they're the first ones who are buying this product. They want to be the first ones in their market with it. So these are very, very important needs that people have. We also know that people want comfort and they want security, they want companionship, they want knowledge, they want understanding, they want self-actualization, they want to feel that they are growing toward the realization of their potential, they want to feel that they're becoming everything they're capable of becoming, they want to feel that they're not missing anything in life. This is one of our great drives. We want to feel that somehow we're smelling all the flowers along the way. And products that appeal to that, whether it's a trip to Tahiti with Club Med, whether it's a life insurance policy that will guarantee that our family will be taken care of no matter what happens to us in life, whether it's a new home in a suburb that when our friends come, they'll admire us and respect us because we're doing so well. These are deep needs. Self-preservation is also a need. That's why life insurance and safety gadgets and materials are so important. All buying decisions are emotional. This is very important, and one of the most critical things is that all decisions are emotional in origin. Try to say that there's a difference between emotion and logic. No, there's not. All decisions are emotions. Everything that we do is 100% emotional. If we say we're going to do this for logical reasons, it's just that means that we have more emotion invested in that reason than we have in another reason. The basic emotions that we talked about are desire for gain, desire to be better off, and fear of loss, fear of being worse off. And we know one thing about emotions is that it takes a stronger emotion to overcome a weaker emotion. That it's always the stronger emotion that predominates in decision making. So if a person has the fear of loss, the fear of making a mistake, the fear of making a failure, that's an emotion. The only way that we can overcome that emotion is by making the desire for gain, the desire to be better off, the desire to be more comfortable, more popular, more admired, rich, respected, up to date, making that desire more intense than the fear of loss, than the emotion involved with fear. And whenever a person says, well, I like to think about it, or I'm not sure, or let me talk it over with someone, what they are saying is that you have not aroused my desire to own or enjoy the benefits of your product to the point that you have overcome my fear of loss or making a mistake. That's all they're saying, is that you have not given me enough value reasons to cause me to make a buying decision. In other words, we're still out of balance. My fear of loss is still greater than my desire for gain, which means it's up to you to put more and more on that scale, more weight on the scale of value, to take away from the emphasis on loss. Business people buy for one reason. When you're selling to business people who sell for resale, they buy for one reason. If a person is going to buy from you to resell, then they're concerned only with net profit. Business people who are buying products or services, if you're selling directly to businesses and the business people use it themselves, they are also concerned with improved profits. They're not concerned with what the product is, they're concerned with the benefit, and the benefit is always greater profits. Now, there's several ways that you can get greater profits. You can cut costs. That increases profits. You can increase productivity, holding costs constant. That increases profits. Or you can improve performance, either of machinery or of people. That improves profits. You can get greater sales volume as a result of using your product or service. That increases profits, holding costs constant. I've had many people say, I just can't get through to business people. And let me give you one example. A woman who was selling office automation systems. She said to me, I just can't seem to get appointments. I call up and I say that we do office automation consulting, and I know that because of our experience, we can really save people a lot of money if they'll have us in and give us a chance to examine their facilities and so on. We can find ways to save them money. I said, well, how do you approach people? Well, she said, what I do is I telephone and I say, I am Betty Dean from Office Automation Products, and we'd like an opportunity to come in and show you how some of our products can increase your efficiency and the smoothness of your administration. And they say, no, thank you. I'm too busy. We don't have the time right now. We're out of money. We don't have it in the budget, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I said, look, why don't you try it a little bit differently? And she made the big mistake of trying to sell on the phone. Next time you make an appointment, call up and say, we have developed a method whereby you can save 20 to 30% in your office administration costs. It would take me about 10 minutes to show you and to tell you about it. And asked for an appointment. She found that she got appointments all the time. Because people weren't interested in office automation products and electronic information transfer and all that. They're interested in saving money. They're interested in increasing profits. If you're talking to somebody who is in administration, they're interested in cutting costs. If you're talking to somebody who's in marketing or sales, who owns the company or is a principal in the company, they're interested in increasing profits. So always talk about your product in terms of what they want, not in terms of what you're selling. Because if your product cannot improve the operations of an existing business so that they either increase their revenues, holding costs constant, or decrease their costs, holding revenues constant, then you shouldn't be selling it to them, should you? In all honesty. In other words, if you cannot improve their condition, you can't sell the product to them. Psychologically, it is impossible for human beings to make a decision to end up worse off than before. We cannot make a decision that will specifically, concretely end us up worse off than we were before. We can only make decisions to improve ourselves. The alternative is to not make a decision at all. And people who do not make decisions at all are people who are not convinced that they're going to be better off as a result of using the product or service. And that's where all of our job has to be, is to prove that the benefits that we are offering are the benefits that are going to be enjoyed. The basic rule of selling is this: people do not buy products, they buy benefits. And our job is to sell benefits. And our job in the sales conversation is to find out what benefits this person would be willing to pay for. What benefits are uppermost in the concern of this person? If you're talking to a sales manager, for instance, about a product or service that you offer, the sales manager is concerned with what? Greater sales volume. He's not concerned with profits because he cannot affect profits. He is rewarded on the basis of the volume of sales. So if you talk to him about cutting costs or increasing profits, you're talking about something that is not a need or a concern of his. If you talk to a business person or an entrepreneur or manager about cutting costs, it may be relevant. You talk to them about increasing profits, it may be relevant because that is of concern to them. So we always have to identify the basic needs, and one of the basic need analysis that we can do is remember that you uncover needs by questioning skillfully and listening carefully. We find that people think about themselves at least 95% of the time. About 95% of the time, people are sitting there thinking about their own problems and their own needs. And the job of the salesperson is to establish rapport and to ask questions and listen carefully, because if you let people talk for any period of time, they will tell you their basic need or concern with regard to your product. And the very best questions to use to uncover needs are the six honest serving men. What are you doing in this area right now? When did you start doing this? Where do you currently get your supplies? How did you start in this area or start using this particular product? Why would you be thinking about changing? And who are you dealing with now, or who would be involved in the decision, or so on? These questions are all open-ended questions, and they cannot be answered no to. They require a specific answer or an elaboration. In Freudian psychology, they have something called the Freudian slip. The Freudian slip is just the simple fact that if a person is encouraged to talk often enough or long enough about themselves, they will subconsciously, inadvertently, tell you their most important concern. If you will listen to customers closely enough and ask them questions skillfully enough, they will eventually tell you everything that you need to know to be able to sell them. This is why the very best salespeople are very low-keyed. The very best salespeople are very good questioners, and they are excellent listeners. The old school of selling, where you had a very, very sharp pattern, you went in and you just talked the person to death, is all gone. Today, people do not want to be sold. They want to be bought. Your job as a salesperson today is that of an advisor, and that of a counselor, and that of a consultant. And if you look upon yourself as a sales consultant or a sales advisor, a product advisor, you will be seeing yourself, you'll be developing a self-concept that is consistent with your role. Because products today are so much more complex than most customers can understand, what they need is a friend to advise them on the best choices and decisions for them. They don't need somebody to try to sell them something. They need somebody to teach them what the product can do for them. We know also that because of habits, people naturally resist new things. So the key today is, instead of presenting a product as something new, always present it as an improvement. Not new. You don't say this is a new product. This is an improvement, or a step forward, or a development in the field that might be better than what they're currently using. Everybody's interested in improvements. Nobody's interested in something new. Customers want the simple truth about a product or service. They want honest information about how it can help them improve their lives and improve their businesses. They resist and they resent any kind of high pressure. The salesman can satisfy basic subconscious needs of the customer. Some of the basic subconscious needs of the customer are to be respected. The salesperson can do that. The needs of the customer are to be listened to. The salesperson can do that. The needs of the customer are to have honest advice to help them do their job better or live their life better. The salesperson can give that. And these deep subconscious needs and satisfying needs is what separates the professional from the amateur. Finally, with regard to quality, quality is never the primary argument for buying anything. Quality is a logical argument. People buy things emotionally, but quality is always based on logic. And the only time that we bring quality into the argument, some people say mine is the finest quality machine in the business. It doesn't matter. The only thing that the individual, the prospect, is interested in is, will it do the job for me? Is it adequate to do the job? A person can say that a Rolls-Royce is the finest quality automobile, but if all you need is a car to get back and forth from work, you don't need to buy a Rolls-Royce. Quality only comes into the argument when you are comparing your product at a certain price against another product at a certain price, and there are very definite reasons why the person should be concerned about quality. For instance, if you're selling a snowmobile to an Eskimo who's going to have to drive it on the polar ice cap, and if it breaks down, he's going to freeze to death, then quality is a very, very important consideration. If you're selling a Land Rover to someone who's going to drive it across the Sahara, it's very important that it be a quality vehicle, because if it breaks down, it can make an enormous difference. But if it's not necessary, then it is not a buying feature. In discussing quality features, you must always explain how they benefit the customer. In other words, when you discuss quality, you say, this is the benefit of this kind of quality. This is the reason why you should buy it. This is what it does for you. Remember that every customer's favorite radio station is WIIFM. What's in it for me? That's all they want to know, is what's in it for me? What's the benefit of what you're saying? What's the benefit of this quality? Every single customer is asking this question to every statement that you're making. They're always saying in their own mind, so what? We often find that salespeople will go on and on about how good their company is and how good their products are and what great people work for them and so on. But the customer's always asking, what's in it for me, with regard to what you're saying? And they're saying, so what, in response to what you're saying. So make sure that every single thing that you say to a prospect has a definite benefit in it for the customer, and you can never go wrong. The product must always be the most suitable for what the customer needs before quality enters into the equation. A perfect example is Japanese automobiles. Japanese automobiles are very finely made automobiles. They also tend to be ideal and appropriate for the majority of uses of people who use cars in our society. They also happen to have good fuel economy, and they also happen to have very reasonable prices. In addition to that, they're good quality. But the quality always comes after the utility has been demonstrated. So the quality of the sales presentation, the material in the sales presentation, the appearance of the salesperson extends to the quality of the product itself. Many people don't realize that 90% or even more of the contact that we will have with a company is the person themselves and the way they talk to us. That's why if a person is well turned out, well dressed, properly groomed, polished, and their presentation is professional and orderly and thought through in every single step, we naturally assume that the company is a high quality company too. If the person is sloppy, if their car is dirty, if their briefcase has got sandwiches and old socks in it, and they've forgotten their price list and they're not sure about the answer to this, then we naturally assume that the company is going to be sloppy too. So part of the quality of the sales presentation is the person themselves. That is why companies like IBM and Hewlett-Packard go through 5 and 6 and 7 interviews. They take people out to dinner, they meet their families, they interview them in groups and individually to make sure that they're the type of people that they want representing their company, because they know that an enormous amount of the buying decision is going to be based on the quality of the people who are selling. Your job is to identify the basic and secondary needs that your product can satisfy, and then demonstrate this to the customer. By asking questions skillfully, somewhere along the way, the person is going to say, well, does it do this? Or what about that? Or does this include it in it? That is an indication, a Freudian slip, that that's what the person is interested in. Let's take the example of microcomputers. There's a lot of people selling microcomputers. Microcomputers are a very, very big business, growing exponentially, 20% a year. Yet most people who sell them improperly. They go in and they try to sell the small business owner on a machine that's going to do financial statements and a VisiCalc and financial projections and so on and so forth, none of which small business companies ever use. We don't use VisiCalc. We don't use pie-shaped, graph-shaped bar charts. We don't use financial spreadsheets and things like that. What we do is we do basic communications with our customers, basic accounting, payables, receivables, monthly balances, general ledger, and so on. But even that isn't why we buy a microcomputer. Why we buy a microcomputer is to save money on administrative costs and to increase efficiency so we can get more business. And the very most successful salespeople of microcomputers come in to the office and say, for $350 a month, I can give you back $1,000. Do you think the person is not interested? Do you think that the prospect would not like to hear a little bit more about what the person has to say? Instead of coming in and saying, if you buy this machine, you can do all this technical, mathematical formulations, and it only costs you $350 a month. At that, it's only an expense. At $350 in exchange for $1,000, it's an investment, and an investment that pays off. And this is applicable to many products. The best salespeople of microcomputers concentrate all of their efforts on demonstrating the payoff of the machine once it's installed. How much money you're going to save or additional business you're going to generate as a result of having this piece of machinery. Once the person's convinced that they can enjoy those benefits, then the price becomes irrelevant, doesn't it? Then they'd be crazy not to buy one, wouldn't it? I mean, if you could pay $350 and get an extra $1,000 a month, you should buy 50 of them if you could use them, right? Well, this is what we mean in talking about focusing in on the key benefit. Your job is to identify the basic and secondary needs that your product can satisfy. And remember, as long as you're focusing all of your attention on the customer and what he or she wants or needs, you're selling professionally. We like to use the example of a spotlight. And imagine that there's a spotlight between you and the customer and it swivels back and forth. And whoever the spotlight is on is the most important person. And as long as the spotlight is on the customer, which means as long as you're talking about him or her and his or her needs and his or her problems and his or her objectives and requirements, then the spotlight is on them. The instant you start talking about your product, your service, your company, your life story, the spotlight is on you. The more the spotlight is on him or her, the greater the possibility of you making a successful sales transaction. The more the spotlight is on you and your company and your product, which is of great indifference to him. Remember, people don't buy products, they buy benefits, and benefits are always theirs. As long as the focus is on you, the emphasis in the sales conversation is in the wrong direction. And so focus all of your attention. What do you need? What are you after? What are you looking for? Why would you buy this? What are you presently using? What has been your previous experience in this area? What would cause you to change? Which brings us to two key points here. In every sales conversation, there is a key benefit. The key benefit is the benefit, the major benefit that would cause the person to buy the product. Also, there is a key issue, which is the major objection that would hold the person back from buying the product. Your job in the course of the sales interview is to uncover the key benefit and then uncover the key issue. Now, the key issue could be price. The key issue could be lack of understanding of the product. The key issue could be your competitor's additional features. The key issue could be a variety of things. But you cannot sell until you've uncovered that key issue or key objection or major reason within the mind of the buyer that's causing them to hesitate about going ahead. You also cannot sell until you've uncovered the key benefit. We talked about the 80-20 rule a little while ago, that 80% of the value of any group of economic items will be represented by less than 20% of the items. Also holds true in selling, is that if you have 10 features or 10 things that your product can do for a customer, 80% of the value of those 10 will be contained in two of the items. And in most cases, it's actually the 90-10 rule, in that 90% of the buying decision will hinge on 1 or 10% of the things that your product or service can do for that customer. Not all the others. The others will be nice, and the others will be enjoyable, the others will be necessary, but 90% of the decision will probably come to hinge on one benefit that your product can offer. And which brings us to what we call the hot button close, which is considered to be the most powerful of all closes. If you can uncover the hot button, then you must focus all of your time and attention and concentrate on proving overwhelmingly to the prospect's satisfaction that if this is what he or she wants from the product or service, you can absolutely guarantee that that is what they're going to get. The hot button close success depends upon the ability of the salesperson to discover the most important reason for buying the product and then repeating it over and over again. To concentrate on selling that one main point, the point that is decisive for buying action, find it and convince him overwhelmingly of it, and bring the whole decision to hang on that one question. They say press the hot button over and over, but a very good way to uncover this is simply this, is ask the person, Mr. Prospect, especially when they're being reluctant, Mr. Prospect, if ever you were to buy this product, what would cause you to do it? What specific benefit or specific reason would cause you to buy this product if ever you're going to buy it? And if you want to do some market research and you sold before, go back to your existing customers and say, Mr. Customer, we sold you this 3 months ago. I'd like to ask you a question. And the question is simply this. Why did you buy it? What was the one reason that caused you to buy it? Can you remember what it was? And often they'll say, well, I'll tell you, this is why I bought it. And very often they will tell you the key reason that you can then go out, and that's the hot button that you can push on everybody else that you talk to. There's an interesting story about the real estate salesman who takes a couple to show them a house. The house is a little bit old, but as the couple and the real estate salesman pull up in front of the house, the woman looks, and in the back of the house, there's a beautiful flowering cherry tree. And she says, oh, Harry, look at that beautiful flowering cherry tree. There's a flowering cherry tree in my backyard when I was a little girl, and I've always wanted to live in a house with a flowering cherry tree. And Harry says, shh, never mind, never mind. They get up and they go inside the house. The salesman's no dummy. They go in the house, and Harry, of course, is being the critic. And he says, oh, well, it looks like we're going to have to recarpet it. And the salesman says, yes, that's true. But from here, just look, you can see out through the dining room, you can see that beautiful flowering cherry tree. And the woman looks. And he knew that the woman almost invariably makes the buying decision on the house. And he went into the kitchen. They said, well, the kitchen's a bit small. The plumbing's a little bit old. He said, yes. He said, but just look. Out through the window, you can see that beautiful flowering cherry tree when you're preparing dinner. And they went upstairs, and he said, the bedrooms are too small, and the paint needs to be replaced, and the wallpaper's old. He said, yes, but from every room, you have that beautiful view of that flowering cherry tree. Well, by the end of the sales transaction, the woman was so excited about the flowering cherry tree, she couldn't see anything else, and the buying decision was made. They bought the house because of the flowering cherry tree. In every single product that we sell, there is a flowering cherry tree. If this is a real prospect, there is something in our product that prospect really, really wants to enjoy, a benefit that prospect really, really wants. For instance, many companies who are buying small computers are buying them simply because of their word processing capacity. Most small business people, I will tell you, are entrepreneurs. They have very little patience for detail. They consider bookwork and accounting and finance to be a pain in the neck. They don't like to do it, and they don't do it well. If you go in and you try to sell a small businessman on how well this does accounting, they're not interested. What they're interested in isn't selling products. They're interested in communicating with their customers. They're interested in delivery. They're interested in performance. They're interested in profits and so on. If you talk about it as a machine that will enable them to dramatically increase the quality of their contact with their customers, then they're interested. You see, so we must always be careful that we sell in terms of what our customer is interested in rather than what we are interested in. Going on now, let's talk about creative selling. How do we sell creatively? Well, in creative selling, we have to understand that creativity is a natural characteristic of all top salespeople, and that creativity is a matter of self-concept. Every single one of us is highly creative. Every single one of us, when we are trying to avoid a traffic jam to get from one part of the city to another, and we're taking side roads and side streets and alleys and so on, we are engaging in highly creative acts. Every single one of us, when we are trying to arrange a party or put together a sales presentation or to convince somebody of something that we want them to do, is engaging in a highly creative act. When we get dressed in the morning and we match clothing and ties and shirts and blouses and dresses and shoes and so on, is an act of creativity. Many of us, however, think that we're not particularly creative. And to the degree to which we believe that we're not particularly creative, we won't be. To the degree to which we believe we are, we will continually come up with creative solutions. And there's several areas where creativity is necessary. We know also that creativity is stimulated by focused questions, by pressing problems, and by burningly desired goals. The more intensely we desire to accomplish something, the more creative we are in its accomplishment. The more focused and specific the question, the more creative we are in answering it. And the more intensely desired or the more pressing the problems, the more creative we are in resolving them. So here's several areas of creativity which grow with use and exercise. Number one is to find new and better prospects. Very, very important area of creativity, which we'll come to in a second. To uncover buying motives, you have to be very creative in finding out what will cause the person to buy. Because many people have inbred buying resistance, which means they don't want to tell you why it is that they might buy your product. Because they know from experience that if you find out what they really want to enjoy, and you keep repeating that argument over and over again, they will be too weak to resist it. Isn't that true? To overcome buyer resistance or indecision. Overcome this, I want to think about it, or let me talk it over with my boss, or call me back next week. This requires tremendous acts of creativity. To discover new product uses and applications. To discover new ways that you can use old products. And to create sales where none exist. And this is so important because every single sales act is an act of pure creativity. What you are doing is you are putting together a business transaction, which is, if you like, the backbone of our society, where nothing existed before. You are literally creating it with your own mind in conjunction with your product and the customer. And that's why develop creativity is very, very important. And I'll give you some methods to develop in a second. So remember, creative selling begins with thorough knowledge of your product or service. The better you know your product or service, the more thoroughly you master the detail of it, the more creative you are in selling it. The fastest way to increase your income is how? To spend more time with better prospects. So creative prospecting is important, and this requires analysis and planning. Basic analysis begins with three questions, and I'd like you to answer these three questions. What are the 5 to 10 most attractive features of your product? List them in order of importance. Why should somebody buy your product? What is it about your product that makes it worthwhile that somebody should buy it? So you need to know the answers to these before you can prepare a sales presentation. So the next question is, what needs of your prospective customer do these product features satisfy? What benefit does it offer? In other words, what's in it for the customer to purchase your product? And write these down opposite the 5 to 10 points that you put down. Remember, every one of your customers is looking for benefits. They're not looking for features. The features are simply a means to an end. So then we go and we say, all right, let us say that you have successfully conveyed the features in question one and the benefits in question two, and the person is now very interested in enjoying the benefits that you have described in your product or service. Then the next question is, why should they buy it from your company? List 5 to 10 reasons why the person should buy it from you. Now they're convinced that they want it. Why should they buy it from you? What does your company offer that other companies don't offer? Now, going on to strategic selling, and these questions are the most important questions that you will ever ask and answer in moving to high levels of income in selling. In strategic selling, you begin by identifying your best possible customer market and then concentrating on it single-mindedly. Again, we said this earlier, one of the biggest mistakes that salespeople make is they look upon everybody as being a prospect of equal value, when in some cases, one prospect may be worth 100 times the value of another prospect. The basic rule in selling is always fish for whales, not minnows. Remember, if you catch 1,000 minnows, what have you got? A bucket full? But if you catch one whale, you've got a whole ship full. And it's very important that we carefully identify where our biggest breakthrough opportunities are. And this comes from asking these questions. Who exactly is your customer? Who buys your product or service right now? The next question is, who might be buying it in the future? Remember, you're going to live the rest of your life in the future. And all of your income is going to come from who you sell to in the future as opposed to who's bought it in the past. So who might be buying it in the future? What direction is your market going in? Who bought it in the past? What is the continuity between past and future? Where are their markets opening up or likely to open up for your product or service? The next question is, why does your customer buy? What benefits or advantages does he perceive in purchasing your product or service? Now, who or what is your competitor? Who is your major competitor? Or what is your major competitor? In some cases, our major competitor is the ignorance of the market. People do not know that your product is available, or they do not know that the product is available of the quality and price that you have to offer. That may be your major competitor. That may be your major obstacle to selling. But then again, it may be another competitor. It may be that people are buying something else to replace your product, or there's somebody else selling exactly your same product and they're buying that. Who is your competitor? All decisions with regard to sales and marketing have to be made in consideration of what you're competing against. Selling, in some respects, is similar to warfare. Decisions in warfare are always made in consideration of what the enemy is doing. And considerations in selling are always taken in consideration of what your competitors or your competition is doing. Now, this is the key question. And it's, what is your competitive advantage? Where do you have an advantage over your competitors? What is your area of excellence in your product or service? What is your unique selling feature? What do you have to offer that nobody else has to offer? Because this is invariably the key reason why people will buy your product over a competitor's, And this is the key to developing an effective sales presentation. You must know clearly and unequivocally so that somebody could wake you up at 3 o'clock in the morning and shake you and say, why is your product better than anybody else's? And you could say, it's better because of this. And you could say instantly, you know exactly the reason where your product stands out above all other products. It does something that other products don't do. Or you offer something that other products or other services other companies don't offer. But what is it that is unique and special about your product or service? Nobody is going to buy your product just because it's as good as anybody else's. They will always buy your product because there is something unique about it that makes it better in their eyes and for their purposes and for their needs than any other product in the market. And your key job is to identify that unique selling feature, that competitive advantage that sets you head and shoulders above anybody else, and build your sales presentation around that. Let me give you an example. I had a young man come up to me who sells electrical supplies not long ago. And he was one of 10 companies that sold electrical supplies. And they all bought their supplies from the same suppliers. They all sold them at the same prices, and they all sold them to the same customers, and they were selling in a depressed market. He said, how can I develop a unique selling feature or a competitive advantage? And I said, I don't think it's possible. Based on what he had told me, what he was selling was something that anybody could buy anywhere else at the same price and the same quality and the same terms, and there was no unique selling feature. I said that in a situation like that, if you don't have the exclusive right to a particular market or a particular product or a particular service, then you will never be able to achieve high levels of success because your customers can always get the same thing from a variety of other places identically. So what you have to do is think very seriously of selling something that has something special or unique about it, and especially something special or unique that you can get excited about, something special or unique that you really consider to be important and that you can become enthusiastic about in telling customers about it. An example of a unique selling feature is IBM. IBM has a slogan throughout the company, at every level, throughout the world, and it is IBM means service, which means that when we think about IBM, we think about a product that will be properly serviced no matter what goes wrong with it, don't we? And we know that customers will pay a premium for IBM products because one of their greatest needs, the benefits that they seek, is that once they've bought the product, they want to be sure that it's going to continue running, that they're not going to be stuck with a lemon. And IBM stands four square, $1 billion a year behind service. So we'll pay 50% more, even 100% more, for an IBM product that will do the same job because of that particular unique benefit. For example, in Southern California, another example of a unique benefit, back in the early 50s, they were trying to introduce Smirnoff vodka. And they had a terrible time. It was selling number 19 amongst distilled liquors in the United States. And they changed advertising agencies two or three times, and they still could not get people to try vodka because most people in the U.S. and Canada considered vodka to be a foreign drink, an alien drink, if you like, a Russian drink. So they tried and they tried and they tried. Finally, after about the sixth advertising agency, one of the copywriters sat down and studied vodka and studied the qualities or characteristics of the drink to try to determine what about it was unique. What was different from other distilled liquors? And he found it very soon, it was, that you could drink vodka and people would not be able to smell it on your breath. So he came up with an advertising line. Actually, he came up with two. The first one was Smirnoff Vodka, dot, 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 it leaves you breathless. And the second one was Smirnoff Vodka, dot, 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 it takes your breath away. Smirnoff Vodka went from less than $19 million of sales in 1954 to over $100 million of sales in 1956 and is over $1 billion in sales now. And there are over 50 companies selling vodka on the tails, if you like, of Smirnoff Vodka because it's been one of the most successful distilled liquors. It's the second or third best-selling distilled liquor in the world today because everybody knows that if you want to drink at lunchtime or if you want to drink before you go home and you don't want anybody to know, if you want them just to think that you're just plain stupid instead of drunk, you can have a couple of drinks of vodka and nobody's going to know. They found the unique selling feature, and every product, I believe, if it has the ability, has that unique selling feature that if you can find it, you can so dramatically increase the amount of it that you can sell as to be beyond all belief. And this is where the focus of your creativity must be. Why do your customers buy from your competitors? How could you offset this? What benefits do your customers perceive in buying from your competitors? Why do they select your competitors' products over yours? And how can you offset this? What can you do to undermine that benefit or to make your benefits appear to be greater or more important than what your competitors can offer? So here's some of the other questions which I suggest you review in your own time. Who are your non-customers? The people who buy neither from you or from your competition. The ones who are not even in the market at all. Let me give you an example. The biggest non-customer in our society is the person who does not vote. The non-voter, if he could be or she could be induced to the polls in any given election, would determine every single election in our country. But the 35 or 40% of people who never vote themselves are the greatest single voting bloc in the country. The people who are not buying your product or anybody else's product are the greatest single source of new customers if you can find out why it is that they're not buying anything. Why is it that they're not using it? People never thought of buying computers up until a few years ago, and then they came out with computer games. And suddenly everybody went crazy about computer games, and for the first time people thought of buying small computers and taking them home. In other words, they found a way to sell to the non-customer. Why are they non-customers? Why don't they buy? And then ask yourself this question with regard to your customers and to non-customers. When do they buy? When is the best time to sell to your customers? Is it a certain time in the business cycle? Do they buy when business is growing? Do they buy when business is declining? Some services are most appropriately sold when businesses are in difficulty. Some are most appropriately sold when businesses are growing rapidly. So if that's the case, don't try to sell to a business that is in the wrong time of the business cycle. What season of the year do they buy? Do you notice that most ski shops shut down in the summertime? They're not crazy enough to stay there all summer and try to sell to people in the summertime, and they open up again in the winter. What stage of the product life cycle? This is very important. Many customers will buy a product as soon as it comes into the market. Some customers will wait for a while and then buy the product after that. As a matter of fact, there's a scale, and it's like this. It's the impulse buyer. When the product first comes into the market, a few people will buy it immediately. 5 to 10% of people are plungers. They'll try it out whether it's good or not. After the plungers comes the second phase of the market. This is the most profitable phase of all. Many companies that introduce new products don't realize that it's a tough slog getting the product into the market for the first year or 2 years. Then suddenly, everybody decides to come in because they see the product, they see that it works, they see that it's not being withdrawn, and a whole lot of people come in, and this is the greatest sales period and the greatest profit period. Then you have the period of maturity, where the latter stage of buyers come into the market, and they come in, now that everybody's got one, they decide that it's safe to come in, and they buy a few, but by this time the competition has come into the market. The margins are much narrower, the profits are much slower, the sales are much more competitive. And finally, you have what is called your post-mature buyer. Your post-mature buyer is the one who bought the Edsel 2 years after it was discontinued. They don't buy a product or service until it's getting old. They are so careful about buying. This is what you might call your apathetic buyers. We'll talk about a little bit later. They won't buy anything until it's been around for so long that there's not a question in their mind that it's safe to buy it. So you have to ask yourself, what period of the product life cycle does your buyer buy? If your buyer's a plunger, he may buy it early. If he's one who's pretty progressive and forward-looking, he'll buy it after it's become established. He may not buy anything until it's been out for a couple of years, and he may be a post-mature buyer. That's a very important thing, and you can find this out by asking them when they bought other products that they have, when they came into the market, how long have they been doing what they've been doing, they'll tell you. And another thing is, do they buy it when others have recommended the product? Many people will not buy anything until they have a recommendation from somebody they respect. That's why the value of testimonial letters is so high. If you can go to a company in your industry that buys your product and get a letter from the person who has purchased the product and take it to somebody else in the same industry and say, look, the president of ABC Company, which sells similar products, has bought one, and here's a letter from him saying how happy he was or how happy she was. By the way, with regard to testimonial letters, the easiest way to get testimonial letters is, first of all, to ask for them and say, would you write me a letter telling me how happy you are? And the second way is to write the letter for the person and ask them if they would type it up on their letterhead and sign it. And you'll be surprised. If your customers are happy and you've taken good care of them, they will take your letter. They may make a couple of corrections in it. They'll have it typed up right there while you wait on their letterhead, and they'll sign it. And you can carry it around in a plastic page. And that plastic page testimonial is worth an hour of you trying to tell the customer yourself how good the product is. That testimony, if the person is interested, he can call because there's the telephone number right there on the plastic page. So I very strongly suggest that you do this. If you have happy customers, go back to the happy customers, write a nice letter saying, when we were first approached by your company, we were a little bit hesitant about buying the product or service, but we decided to go ahead because we were very impressed with the presentation, and we tried it out, and this is what has happened to us, and we are certainly happy we made the buying decision because these are the results that we've gotten. That kind of a letter is worth its weight in gold, and if you've got half a dozen letters like that, you can double or triple your sales just on referrals, because many people will not buy until they have read a testimonial from somebody that they respect. We've talked about this before. What causes us to go to a new restaurant? It's word of mouth advertising, isn't it? We don't look in the newspapers and say, well, there's an advertisement for a restaurant, let's go and try it out. We wait till we hear somebody else tell us, hey, that's a good restaurant, you should give it a try. That's when we go to the restaurant, isn't it? So if that's when people buy, then be very alert to that. And don't be reluctant to ask your customers or prospects for the answers. Go and sit down with them and ask these questions. Say, look, we're doing some market research and we're talking to some of our most esteemed customers to find out how we can serve them better in the future. Would you answer a few questions for me? Your customers will tell you how to sell additional customers. The people who've bought from you are your very best source of valuable, if not priceless, information to sell to additional people. And most salespeople in their whole careers never think to ask. They sit at home and guess. They hope that what they have is the right answer, and often your customers will tell you, well, I bought it because of this, and you'll say, geez. And you know how often we miss it? They'll say, geez, did you buy it because of that? We'll say, I'll be darned. And you've been selling it on the basis of something else all along. Very, very important. Now, finally, with regard to creative selling, the creative method, and this method was developed by Earl Nightingale some years ago, and more salespeople have earned their way to high earnings in their professions with this method than any other method that I've ever seen. It's called the 20 idea method. If you will use this method every day for the next month and apply some of the ideas that you generate, you will double your income within the next 90 or 180 days. If you do not double your income by reading 30 minutes every morning and using this method on a regular basis, then it's not possible for you to double your income in this lifetime. How's that for a sweeping statement? What you do is you take your key problem, your most pressing goal, your most pressing question, and you write it first thing in the morning at the top of a piece of paper in the form of a question. For instance, here's some examples. How can I increase my ratio of closes to calls? In other words, how can I close more of the people that I call on? And there's a series of answers to that. How can I increase my sales effectiveness today? Or here's another one. How can I utilize my time better today? Or how can I structure my time so that I see more prospects every single day? You write it at the top in the form of a question, and then you sit down and you write out 20 answers to the question. You force yourself to sit there until you come up with 20 answers, one after another. Now, the first few answers will come easily. The second few answers will become more difficult. But take the logical answer and then take the opposite of the logical answer. One could be get up early in the morning and get going earlier. The other could be get up later in the morning and get going later. Write the opposite and see what it looks like. Another could be a synthesis of the two. Get up earlier in the morning and prepare, and maybe start a little bit later, but have every single call prepared for and by confirmed appointment. In other words, how much more successful do you think you're going to be if you're generating hundreds of ideas a year and you're implementing one new idea a day to increase your income and your effectiveness? I guarantee you that this idea will just blow you away. As a matter of fact, by the second or third day that you've been generating ideas like this, you will have so many ideas and so many new ways to develop more business, you will not have enough time in the day to do it. I promise you that you try it for 3 days, you will be staggered at the quality of the ideas that come out of your mind. You just will not believe it. You cannot believe that you wrote that down. It's such an excellent idea. And all you need is one good idea. One good idea that's a little bit newer. Marshall McLuhan once said that all you need is an idea that's 10% new to make $1 million. That's all it has to be, is 10% new. It doesn't have to be a major breakthrough. All of the great money-making ideas of today are not brand new products or services. They are merely marginal improvements on existing products that open up whole brand new markets. Isn't that true? And if you use this idea and use this regularly and develop 20 ideas a day, you will be astonished. You will become one of the most creative salespeople and, by extension, one of the most highly paid salespeople in your profession. And once you develop this knack of creativity and analysis, there is nowhere that you can't go, and there's no product that you can't sell successfully as long as you believe in it.